Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Susan Ryan has had a long career in public life. She was a senior minister in the Hawke government and the first woman in a federal Labor cabinet. Now she's with the Human Rights Commission as Age Discrimination Commissioner and recently has taken on responsibility for disability discrimination. Susan Ryan, there seems to be a paradox between the increasing talk of a diminishing labour force as a proportion of the population with the ageing of Australia and the special difficulties that both younger and older people have in the labour market. In terms of the older people, how great is the problem?
It is a very great problem. People, once they've turned 50, if they lose their job, have terrific problems trying to get another job. They spend longer than any other age cohort on Newstart, for example. And the recent significant increases in people taking Newstart are in this older age group, as are the people increasingly seeking the disability support pension. And those two are linked, because if people spend over a year looking for jobs, applying for jobs, getting nowhere, which frequently happens, they often then become susceptible to depression, anxiety, other problems, and before long, they're on the disability support pension. Now, the numbers are huge. I can't give you the exact number, but they are very significant numbers. And we do believe that there are in excess of a million people over 55 who are capable of working and willing to work, but who cannot find work. Some of those, of course, have retired because they're able to draw their superannuation, but they would work if they could. So in terms of our general concern about the economy and the decline in the number of young workers compared with older people who are retiring, part of the answer is staring us straight in the face, and that is make it more possible for people between 50 and 70, for example, who want to work, to get jobs.
Do you think that this problem is going to improve from the workers' point of view as the squeeze on the labour force increases, or do you think it's just endemic in our society that younger workers are preferred?
I think it's endemic. It's a cultural prejudice, if you like, that younger workers are preferred, which is not to say we shouldn't be paying attention to young people wanting to get jobs and not getting jobs. That is also a challenge. But they're different kinds of challenges. The problem with people over 50, most of them, is not that they don't know how to work or they've had no experience, which is often the problem with the younger workers. It's that they can't get jobs because there is a deep-seated cultural prejudice against older people, and many myths are held by employers about the risks of hiring older people. So that...
What sort of myths are those?
Well, employers fear that older workers will be less responsive to any change in the organisation. They're particularly concerned that they won't skill themselves up to use the latest IT, that they are, as they say, set in their ways, that they don't like to work with younger people, that they're intolerant of different social mores. They fear that they will get sick and have more sick days.
Do they?
No. In fact, they have fewer. It's a frustrating issue to deal with because all of these myths have no evidence to support them, and there is evidence against them. And in particular, people over 50 take fewer sick days than other age cohorts. And when you think of it, you can understand why that is the case, because people at that stage are keen to keep their jobs. They know that the chance of being forced into unemployment at that age is very, very dangerous for them.
So they don't take discretionary sick days.
They don't take discretionary sick days. And they've had a lot of experience, so they understand the employer-employee relationship, which doesn't go to, I had a bit of a late night last night, so I might just have a sleep in. So they're good employees. And what I try to do is get together all of the evidence of this and then present it to the employers and the employer organisations.
What about the technology question, though? I mean, it is more than a joke that if you want to manage the latest technology, you get a child.
Well, that's right. And because the changes have been huge and very rapid, and younger people now have done most of their schooling using IT. If they've done university or college, they've used it. Whereas people in their 50s who may have been in an organisation that didn't require them to do it haven't kept up to date. But it can be learnt. And employers who are willing to offer some training and upskilling to their mature employees find that the older worker can pick it up just as quickly and will probably use it much more for work-focused activities maybe than for other social activities, which our younger people like to do.
Just looking at the younger cohort for a moment, do you get many complaints from young people or about young people who have trouble getting jobs?
We do get complaints because the age discrimination legislation prohibits age discrimination at any age. The work-related complaints we get from young people are mainly around the area of youth wages. Either they take the view that they're doing the same job as the person next to them who's 21, but they're being paid less because of, and that's an industrial issue. I'm sympathetic to them. I think the rate for the job is the best way, but all awards don't recognise that. Or the other thing that happens to them, they're employed until they're 19, I think, when the adult wage cuts in because they're cheaper, and then they're discarded. And both of those are unjust situations, not situations that are very much able to be resolved by the Human Rights Commission because they go to industrial awards, but we will investigate such a complaint and offer a conciliation process. And sometimes the employer says, yes, I think this is unfair. I've got a legal right to do it, but it's unfair and this person's a good worker, so I'll keep them on. So that's an area. The other sorts of age discrimination complaints that we get from young people really go to things like rental accommodation. Some landlords say we're not renting to anyone under 25 or we're not renting to groups of young people, and their issues that can be investigated.
And what do you do when you get those complaints?
We investigate them. They're investigated because that is age discrimination. It's not justified. And so the agent either or the landlord either has to come to an agreement with the young people or change their policy, or they may produce evidence to show that this particular group of tenants or this particular young tenant has a bad track record and they're not obliged to take them on.
This is an interesting question because, for example, in matters going to driving and insurance, yes, I think there is that sort of discrimination. Is that fair enough or
and
not?
And look, all age discrimination is not unlawful. Under the Act, first of all Commonwealth legislation is exempted. So the insurance legislation, that part of it's controlled by Commonwealth, is exempted. Nonetheless, in insurance particularly, there's a lot of age discrimination, which in my view is unfair, such as the refusal of insurers to insure people for income maintenance over 65. Now, that's improving a little bit. A couple of the big industry super funds now offer you that income replacement insurance up to the age of 70. But generally, if you're 65 and you're still working, it's very hard to insure yourself for an accident or sickness. And of course, this is particularly problematical if you're working for yourself or you're working in a small business. I have had extended conversations with the insurance industry to try to address this, so far without significant improvement, although we're kind of getting the issue further up the agenda. The other area where there's very blatantly discriminatory insurance premiums is in the area of travel insurance. Once you're 79, it's very, very difficult to find an insurer who will insure you. And if they do, the premium might be five or six times what it would have been the year before you had that birthday. And again, the insurers say this is justified by their actuarial data, but I'm not convinced. So I'm working to get that changed. Young people don't have these insurance problems, although they do have other problems of goods and services where sometimes they're considered too young unfairly.
Now, when you're talking about to employers about age discrimination, and I guess this affects the older people rather than the younger people, but Which employers are the most receptive and which are the least receptive? For example, are big companies more receptive than small businesses? Are regional employers better or worse than city ones?
Well, generally, some big employers have tackled this issue and tackled it well, and I'm aware of those. Now, to be fair, banks in particular, who have improved a lot, insurance companies, they have the resources to do this. They have big human resources departments and they have a lot of staff, so they can focus on, say, the over 50s and make sure they're getting any careers advice, retraining that they need. But also the big companies, banks and insurance companies in particular, have decided that they want to keep their older workforce because the customers like it. It's good for business, in other words. And you can understand that if you're going to negotiate a mortgage or a personal loan and you're in your 60s and the person you're talking to is in their 20s, you might find that communication is not all you want it to be. Similarly, if your house has just burnt down or been flooded and you want to pursue a claim with your insurance company, you really want to deal with someone who's had a lot of experience in claims and who can understand the predicament you find yourself in. So because of customer preference, organisations like banks are now much better at certainly retaining their older workers. There's still a challenge in getting even these aware firms to hire if people in their 50s afresh. However, they get it. Now, the other area where there's some good examples is in retail. The champion in all of this is Bunnings, and Bunnings have had for a long time a policy of hiring older workers, particularly men who've been working in the construction industry, because they, who can no longer climb up and down scaffolding and lay bricks, but they understand all the building materials and the kind of products that Bunnings sells. So obviously, Michelle, if you go in to a Bunnings to find something because you've got a leaky wall in your bathroom, you will be very pleased to find someone who's worked in the building trade all his life and can say, look, love, that stuff's rubbish, try this.
I think I'd have to hire the employee to do the job.
Yes, that's
rather
right.
Than just buy the materials.
But they have a strong commitment, and they have older women working there too for similar reasons, and it's a very successful company. But we need more Bunnings. Woolworths, I think, has got on to the good business sense of keeping their older workers or even hiring their older workers. And of course, in retail like Woolworths, there are a lot of casual jobs or part-time jobs, and they can suit an older worker who may not be in a position to work full-time because they've got an aged parent they're looking after or something like that. Or they might think, well, I've worked all my life, it'd be nice to have a four-day week. And retail, the way retail is structured, they can often find that. But again, it's not all retail. We've got a long way to go. As for smaller businesses, we don't get so many good stories, although I'm sure there are some out there. Because again, if you've got a small business and you're nervous, you've heard these myths about older people being sick or unable to change, you will be more nervous. I mean, for a small business, hiring someone is a high risk thing anyway, because if it doesn't work out, what do you do? So I think we need a lot more support and information and modelling for, say, the businesses and the members of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and we're working on that.
Do you think the government needs to do more, and if so, what?
Oh, yes, I think the government could do. Look, the government is certainly aware of the problem, because in the government's understandable budget objective of reducing expenditure and increasing revenue can only be enhanced if people can work through their 50s and 60s and beyond. So, you know, those people are taxpayers, they're building up their super, they're healthier. We know that people who work are healthier than people who don't work, mentally and physically. So the government's aware of it, and the government has got a positive approach to encouraging older workers. But I think we need more leadership. I think we need more statements coming from the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. I mean, the Treasurer is aware of it, but he has not made it a major communications point, if you like. and I think it would be helpful if they did. I also would like the government to look at how older workers are assisted back into the workforce through the job services, the JSAs and so forth. Most of those services that you go to when you're on Newstart are not suited to the older worker for a variety of reasons. Now, they really should be restructured so that as soon as a person loses their job, they can go and get advice. They may not need financial support, but they can get advice about what to do next instead of having to wait till they've used up all their savings and so forth before they're eligible for any advice. The government has brought in this budget a positive measure. That's the Restart Grant. If an employer takes on a person over 50 who's been on unemployment benefit for at least 6 months, they get $10,000. And that's spread out over a period of 2 years to prevent, you know, churn. But there has been some uptake of that already, and I think that gives a good signal. And I would expect that it will be small businesses for whom a $10,000 assistance is quite important.
Now, we've also seen in this budget the government say the pension age would go to 70 by 2035. What's your view on that?
Well, to look rationally at the ageing demographic, where most of us are now going to live into our 90s and beyond, and this longevity seems to be increasing every year that the actuaries look at it, it makes sense to say that by 2035 people should be able to work till they're 70. So I don't have an objection to the principle of it. But the problem at the moment is we've got people in their 50s unable to get work because of age discrimination, forced onto Newstart, and worse, because of age discrimination. So it's not helpful or productive in budgetary terms to say to them, well, you're 52 and you can't get a job, but we're not going to give you the age pension till you're 70. I really think the immediate question is tackling workforce prejudice against older people, establishing through some well-targeted training allowances and the like, support for pathways back to work. And then I would think if all this happens, by the time we get to 2035, most people will be choosing to work till 70 anyway. So we don't need the stick. We just need the carrot of the jobs being available.
Now, in case you didn't have enough to do, you've now got disability discrimination to deal with. The government has not replaced that as a full-time position. Are you getting enough time to do that?
Well, look, it's a very big challenge, Michelle. My predecessor as Disability Discrimination Commissioner, Graham Innes, had been in the job for many years, and he'd been in associated work at the commission before that. He was more than full-time. He was an absolute dynamo. Graham was blind from birth, so he was very acceptable to the disability sector as a person with a lived experience. Now, that's gone, and I've taken on the role in addition to the age discrimination role. So it's not possible for me to duplicate what Graham did. On the other hand, all my commission colleagues are very supportive of the proposition that the Human Rights Commission will continue to support people with disability in whatever way we can. My commissioner colleagues will also assist in this. I'm finding the meetings I'm having with the sector encouraging. There are a lot of very able people there who are thinking quite strategically. And I am, again, making employment, access to jobs, the focus of the work I'll do, because in the area of disability, like anywhere else, having a job is so much better than not having a job. So I'm hoping that we can see some improvement there in the jobs access area.
Around the place, one does see signs that we as a community are more aware of the needs of people with disabilities than perhaps a decade ago. There's more access arrangements, things like that. But in terms of employment, do you think they're better off than a decade ago?
I'm afraid the last 10 years workforce participation statistics for people with disability are not encouraging. In the Australian Public Service, for example, the numbers are lower than they were a few years ago. In the private sector, where again some companies are really moving into this area very well, Westpac Bank is an example I must quote because they're doing a very good job. NAB is also doing a good job. I think although there's terrific empathy and support for people with disability, and we saw that with the community support for the NDIS and their willingness to pay an extra Medicare levy to help support the cost of that. There's sympathy, but that we still have to break down the barriers that say, look, I feel for this person. Yes, they should have a better wheelchair, or yes, they should have better housing, but am I prepared to employ them? And that last question is the question where we haven't made much progress, no.
And is the more prejudice against people with specific sorts of disabilities? Is it easier for a blind person to get a job than, for example, someone who's intellectually disabled?
I think with a blindness and with people who are in wheelchairs and so on, there is a better acceptance of the capacity of these people to do their job if they've got the right supports in place. IT, for example, has brought a lot of possibilities to blind people because they can have their own form of IT which can plug into Word, any of the computer stuff we use, and they can do what we can do. So you do see more blind people being able to access jobs at various levels. I mean, I'll talk about Graham Innes again, who's had high-level professional jobs for most of his working life and he's blind from birth. People with known intellectual disabilities that is stable, for example, Down syndrome people are known to be very good employees. If appropriate jobs are provided and appropriate supports are in place, we had a person, a Down syndrome man at the commission. He was our longest serving member. He left recently of his own will after 25 years of service because their circumstances are stable. They know what they can do. Their employer knows what they can do and it goes smoothly. The people I think who are most vulnerable now are the people with mental illness, and that's because employers don't understand it. We, as a community, we don't understand mental illness very well, and also because mental illness can be episodic, so that in contrast to the person with Down syndrome, we all recognise this is where the person's at, this is what they can do, that doesn't really change very much. The person with bipolar or some such episodic mental illness does require much more aware management. You hire the person and then it emerges that they have this illness, but when do they suffer from it? They don't suffer from it all the time. These sorts of things make employment opportunities for people with this particular disability more difficult, and added to the difficulty is until very recently, and it's still the case, that people with mental illness don't necessarily want to disclose this to their employers. So they conceal it, but then if they have an episode of the illness, then it's very difficult for everyone. So we need a lot more awareness, a lot more advice to employers, probably a lot more work to create an environment in which an employee feels able to say to his or her manager, I have this problem, and it may affect me from time to time. But we're a long way away from that.
I wonder if I can take you back to your former life, your political life in the Hawke government. You were education minister, and one issue where you disagreed with some of your colleagues was over the imposition of a student charge and the HECS scheme repayments and so on. What do you think of the present government's plan to deregulate education and indeed increase the burden on tertiary students, make them pay more for their fees?
Well, I think it's a big worry for us nationally as a community and as an economy. I mean, certainly I lost the battle over tuition fees a long time ago, and you can't turn the clock back. So I wouldn't expect these days any political party would come to office saying we'll take away all tuition fees. The whole funding of universities and the way they, you know, research is funded and the way teaching is funded now relies on fees. And the HECS system in principle is not unfair. where the concern is that some HECS debts are becoming very, very high, and therefore either only young people with a lot of resources behind them will take on a course that leads to those high debts, or they'll take on the course but find then they struggle to meet their repayments, plus do all the other things like you have to get housing and in many cases raise a family and so on. So I think the level of debt, not for all students at the moment, but for some, can be very high. If deregulation is proceeded with, there is no doubt that our Group of Eight universities will increase tuition fees very dramatically. They've more or less indicated that they want to do that, and they will be able to do it in that there's a lot of competition to get places in their universities, and students will either, again, backed up by affluent parents, or take the risk, look, this is, I'm going into a huge debt, but I'll be able to manage it. And I think it's not a sensible way to develop the intellectual capital of Australia. I don't agree that any fee is worth paying because graduates earn more and therefore over the years they are still better off. That has been the case up till now. We don't know what sort of labour market will prevail in Australia in 20 years' time. So if you've got people with massive $100,000 debts, $150,000 debts from their university days, is that fair? I think not. But is that an efficient way to develop the high-level skills that we want in our economy? I would really hope that the Parliament, which I think is considering these proposals this week, will have in their mind the long-term impact on students themselves, but also on the whole development of our intellectual wealth in Australia, and make sure that excessive burdens aren't the consequence of the deregulation proposals.
And just finally, way back then, you had some responsibility as a minister assisting the Prime Minister for the status of women, for the whole women's policy area. Do you think that the position of women in politics these days has become much better, or somewhat better, or not better at all?
Well, Michelle, if you posed that question to me a couple of years ago, I would have said much better, because not only did we have a female Prime Minister, we had a number of senior female ministers in the Cabinet. We had greatly increased number of women on both sides of Parliament and in the minor parties than we had in my day. So you could say, look, there's been a general increase in participation. Women of political talent have been able to move in. They have been able to get into senior positions.
But then it went a bit pear-shaped at
various
levels.
It did go a bit It did. And I can only hope that women themselves will point out to political parties that this is not the way to proceed. I mean, we started to get an improvement in women in Parliament decades ago, because women themselves, through the Women's Electoral Lobby and other organisations, agitated for it and took action. The Liberal Party, of course, prior to the Women's Electoral Lobby coming onto the scene, had already had Liberal women forming their own committees, particularly in the state of Victoria, where they were able to promote women such as Dame Margaret Guilfoyle. So that was women, that Liberal women got that movement going. And then for a while, there were more Liberal women in Parliament then. Women centre-left and left women pushed Labor and minority parties, and we saw many more women. At the moment, it's not satisfactory. We are missing out on a lot of potential talent, and we are not necessarily getting policies that meet the needs of Australian women.
Susan Ryan, thank you very much for being with us today. And that's all for the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back with you very soon.